And welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are back again for another podcast. And it being Thanksgiving week, I thought, you know, what better time to be talking about Thanksgiving and the things that we're thankful for? And who better to do it with than raconteur, storyteller extraordinaire, fascinating guy, author of Chesterton's America, and The Christus Experiment, and The Apostasy That Wasn't, and Four Witnesses, and all kinds of other fun stuff, Mr. Rod Bennett. How you doing, Rod Bennett?
I'm very well, Mark. How are you?
I'm doing well. I am looking forward so much to Thanksgiving this week. I'm a big fan of Thanksgiving, and I particularly love the whole thing. I love the, you know, I love having the family crammed into the house. We have a not all that big house out in the burbs, and we're going to have 16 people here for Thanksgiving this year, and they're all related to me.
Be a challenge.
Yeah, so I'm going to have my large livestock sons come lumbering in, you know. And well, they're all built like me, you know, all these huge guys. And but, you know, we're also going to have the granddaughters and friends and family, and it's going to be great.
That sounds awesome.
How about you? What do you do for Thanksgiving?
This year I'm going to my parents' home in Marietta, Georgia.
Okay.
And they are going to feed me pretty much the same Thanksgiving meal that I've had since I was a kid. So that sounds great.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say that it involves turkey, mashed potatoes, squash, olives.
Yep. No, maybe not the olives.
That olives.
Maybe a little exotic for our taste.
Oh, okay. Well, you have my complete approval. I hate olives, so...
we probably bring an element of Southern home cooking into our Thanksgiving that may be a little alien to the tradition, but
So what would that be, like hominy or?
Well, it's usually green beans made in a very particular way.
Okay.
The only people in the world who know how to make green beans properly are my family.
Your people, okay?
Yes,
that's good.
And there are, let's see. Well, I suppose anything with sweet potatoes is probably a little Southern.
Sweet potatoes I regard as just weird-shaped squash. So, you know, that fits...
Food for swine, right? Fit only for swine.
Squash is a part of the... I'm not, like, super wild about squash as a general rule. But squash must be served at Thanksgiving and Christmas, or it's just not Thanksgiving and Christmas. And do you get the tin can shaped cranberry jelly stuff sliced up?
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah, I'm afraid so.
Yeah, that's always been part of it. It's like if it's cranberry jelly, but it's not shaped like a tin can. Then I'm skeptical of it, and and I hate cranberries. I never eat it. It's always served. I never eat it. But again, it wouldn't.
You'd miss it if it weren't there.
I would miss it if it weren't there. It's part of the aesthetic. It lends color to the table, and
I think that's its primary purpose.
Yeah, it's red. You know, most foods don't look like it. So, but it's got to be, in fact, nothing
like really Skywalker's blue milk, right?
Yes, exactly. So, yeah, so we'll have the giant sumptuous repast, and we're going to have we're setting up the table out in the living room for the little girls.
That
so they can
awesome.
Have their own, you know, their own spot, but they're not like exiled. Everybody can still see them, and they can still see everybody. But there's just no way you can fit 16 people around our table. So we'll make
that it sounds like a fun adventure.
It's going to be great. It really will. And so you know, Luke will be bringing his ukulele and playing fun tunes, and we'll sing, and it'll just be, yeah. Some people, you know. Maybe this happens out in the Smoky Mountains. I don't know. Do you get snow for Thanksgiving ever?
Sometimes, yeah. I'm actually going to Georgia, where that's a little less common. But, yeah, in fact, we sometimes get a pretty balmy Thanksgiving in Georgia.
Yeah.
And, but this year we might have a little bit, well, there may be a little on the chilly side, so that's more appropriate for Thanksgiving, I suppose.
Frost on the pumpkin. That's what you want.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. It comes later there than it does a lot of the places, but
Georgia?
It looks like we've got a good one here ahead.
Oh, good. Mm-hmm.
It was chilly this morning here, so it was wintry, downright wintry this morning.
Was it?
Here in the mountains.
It's just... Yeah. It's just dank, you know, it's a Seattle November. So we actually startled ourselves by actually having a bit of snow earlier this month, which is really unthinkable in Seattle. And so, you know, hope springs eternal that was a sign of a coming winter that would actually have snow or even, you know, God willing, a white Christmas. But
how about that?
But I've had
one white Christmas in my life, and it was here in East Tennessee.
Yeah,
it actually snowed the night before Christmas, but that's pretty close.
Seattle gets, well, in the past century, Seattle has had 12 white Christmases.
How about that?
So that,
well, that's probably a better record than we've got.
Once a decade, you know. We'll get a white Christmas.
You're not talking about on top of Mount Rainier or anything.
No, we're talking about Seattle. Yeah, yeah. Well, by Seattle, I mean the Tacoma, Seattle, Everett metropolitan area.
Okay. All right.
And actual snow in Seattle is extraordinary because, you know, large cities have a thermal bubble.
Seattle is
no exception. But now and then we'll get this freaky, you know, confluence of bitter cold Canadian air that comes roaring down from the tundra and slams into something wet that's, you know, roaring in off the Pacific. And so we'll get a snowstorm. But it's rare, and it's getting rarer. You know, we've got the whole climate thing going on here as well. We had an extraordinarily long summer here that just went on and on and on. But then suddenly this early snowfall that freaked everybody out and amazed us all. Seattle is 2 inches of snow will paralyze the city.
Yeah. Yeah, that's familiar for somebody who spent a lot of time in Atlanta.
Yeah.
Atlanta is famous for everybody flees for the bunkers when there's half an inch of snow.
So. Yeah. Yeah. So we just close Seattle if it snows 2 inches.
Right. Right.
And so, you know, I hope for that. It's not, for me, it's nice because as a guy who works at home writing, I don't have to anguish about how I'm going to be able to get to work or get home. I'm just, there I am. And so I just sit here and watch it snow outside and feel ever so cozy and a little smug.
Yeah, I was going to say your readers are, your listeners are starting to get envious right now.
Yeah, yeah, burning envy. So I thought we could spend a little time, you know, A, giving thanks, and B, talking about, I figured who better to talk to about Americana and Arcana surrounding Thanksgiving than Rod Bennett, who I have a moral certitude knows all kinds of fascinating trivia about Thanksgiving.
Well, one does pick up a few things.
Yes, yes. So that was part of the reason I wanted to have you on the show, because I figured, you know, plus, of course, that rich, warm molasses and bourbon southern lilt that you've got, you know, just it really adds to the whole country of home.
It ought to be a New England accent, actually, since Thanksgiving is the preeminently New England holiday.
But it's true. It's true. Although, if memory serves, the very first Thanksgiving ever offered was offered in St. Augustine, Florida.
Right, except that we pronounce it St. Augustine down here.
Ah, okay.
If you live in Florida or anywhere around here, you say St. Augustine.
Okay, okay.
I don't know whether there's a correct pronunciation. I know that when I talk about the saint and happen to slip into calling him St. Augustine, people look at me like I'm a hopeless rube. which yeah, I probably well, am. So
well, that's okay.
But if you've ever been, have you ever been to St. Augustine, Florida?
No, I've been to Miami one time. I went there as a complete, you know, naive person from the Pacific Northwest. I am from the point, the place in the continental United States that is absolutely the furthest from Florida.
Miami.
Yes. And, I went there in April of 2000 because they were having some big, like, Year of Jubilee thing, and they wanted me to come down and speak at this thing. So I did. And I don't know what I was expecting, but I thought, well, south, so there'll be a southern twang.
Well, not in Miami. No. There might be South Cuba twang, maybe.
Well, but, yeah, you go to Miami. You know, when I was when I was there, it was like, okay, everybody was either Latino, they were all Cuban refugees or their descendants, or it was like
imports from New York City.
Yeah, it was like welcome to Florida. You know, and it was just, it was all New Yorkers, you know, Catholics and Jews from, Manhattan.
Right. For many, for a long time, that's where New Yorkers went when they died, was to Miami. So they're there.
So I figure, you know, now I'm a little bit more sophisticated. And so I think my guess is you'd have to go up into the panhandle to hear a southern twang.
Well, north central, above Disney World.
Okay.
If you're north of Disney World, you're going to hear real Southerners. But, in fact, my wife's family are, you know, really Florida crackers, as they're called.
Okay.
They are the old timey, you know, farm people of Florida. And
okay.
grew up on her father grew up on a very remote piece of, you know, really farm country, but with, you know, with the Spanish moss and the oak trees and everything you think of about Florida, but
or the
very
south.
Old, very old Southern kind of look. You would definitely have gotten your Southern expectations fulfilled.
Okay.
A little north of Disney World.
Okay.
My wife is from West Florida. Yeah. The Panhandle. So, yeah, that's where her family moved to, but, and where she grew up.
Okay.
But yeah, that's more like the South. In fact, many locals in the Panhandle refer to, they tell people they're from L.A., L.A. meaning Lower Alabama. And so that's pretty much what the Panhandle is. But
that sneeze, by the way, is part of the way that I established that podcasting Connecting the Dots is raw, gritty, unfiltered.
That's right.
Reality. You know,
right in the middle
of the podcast, I could just sneeze, you know, and it really, I'm bringing the truth is what
that
I'm
sounds
doing.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, if you did go to St. Augustine, Florida, which is, North Florida, but on the Atlantic coast.
Hmm.
Yeah. St. Augustine, Florida is the oldest city in America. In other words, it's the oldest continuously occupied European established settlement within the borders of the continental United States.
Oh, okay, cool.
It's founded in 1546, I think.
Okay.
So that's, you know, 70 years before the Pilgrim Fathers. So that alone makes it an interesting place. But if you go, I mean, it remained in Spanish hands effectively until 20 years before the Civil War, our Civil War.
Okay.
It became American territory in 1818. Florida did,
mm-hmm.
and but didn't actually become a state until 1845, I think.
Okay.
So, but Europeans came to Florida. Well, Juan Ponce de Leon came in 1513. He's the one who called it Florida.
Okay.
And he almost certainly had a mass of Thanksgiving when he landed. All the Spanish explorers did.
Sure.
Carried priests with them.
Yeah.
And so that almost certainly was the first Thanksgiving held on what is today the continental United States.
Yeah.
Why you think now, why is that this not more widely recognized? I mean, it is very, very similar to the Puritan story from New England.
Right.
The Indians came and were invited to to participate in a communal meal, and the Thanksgiving service was held and all the rest of it. I mean, it definitely is Thanksgiving in every sense that the Pilgrim version would be later.
Right.
But you think, well, why was this not more commonly recognized in our history? Why does everybody know the Pilgrims and nobody knows Juan Ponce de Leon? Mm-hmm. Two reasons. Obviously, English Protestant bias.
Right.
You know, the English America looks to the English patriots and or at least the people who pass for English patriots.
Or the New England patriots, perhaps. Right. I don't even know.
That too. And also that's going to come with the Protestant bias. So you're not going to find a Catholic mass being glorified in American history until quite a bit later than
right
when these traditions were formed.
Yeah.
The other thing, though, is that Florida didn't actually become part of the United States until well after the Puritan Thanksgiving of New England was already part of our traditions. So, you know, Florida was not part of the 13 colonies and again, didn't come in until much later. So
yeah,
that's probably the reason they don't get credit, but they should.
Yeah.
You know, I suppose some of this might sound like debunking of the Pilgrim Thanksgiving, and I really don't mean it that way. I hasten to add that I'm very glad that America still has Thanksgiving. It's kind of a miracle that she does. It's one of the closest things we've got to a religious holiday on our calendar.
Yeah,
I mean, it has no real purpose except to give thanks, and
right.
There's got to be somebody to give thanks to, so of necessity it involves God.
Right.
I think it was Chesterton who said the worst moment for the atheist is when he feels genuinely grateful, but he realizes he hasn't got anybody to thank.
Right.
And I think Thanksgiving still hits people with that once a year, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's good. I'm glad that it's still there. Chesterton said something else too. He said the Americans have established a Thanksgiving Day to celebrate the fact that the Pilgrim Fathers reached America.
Mm-hmm.
The English might very well establish another Thanksgiving Day to celebrate the happy fact that the Pilgrim Fathers left England.
So true. So true. I've always appreciated Garrison Keillor's remark that the Puritans came to America because they sought a place to be harsher with themselves than English law allowed.
it's true and it's great. I enjoy all of this teasing around with it, but I want to hasten to add for our readers again. Nobody likes Thanksgiving more than I do, so I'm glad it's still here. But there is an awful lot of mythology surrounding it that that probably does need to be thought out a little better, especially since, you know, if we're getting rid of Columbus Day, Thanksgiving can't be too far behind. So it might be.
I don't think anybody's in a big hurry to get rid of a 4-day weekend.
I guess the only advantage to Columbus Day is if you're a mail carrier, right?
Sure.
People have gradually, I think people have gradually wised up a little about the Pilgrim Fathers. I mean, who were the Pilgrim Fathers? They were people for whom English Protestantism, Anglicanism, was too Catholic.
Right.
So they left and tried to go to Holland, where they believed that they would find more thoroughgoing Protestants. they did, but the more thoroughgoing Protestants were still too Catholic for
right.
the Pilgrim Fathers
right.
because they believed in free will and believed
yeah.
that Christians should have, there should be Christian missionaries and things like that.
Right.
Pilgrims, very thorough 5-point predestinarians.
Okay.
So you don't waste your time trying to evangelize people. It's all established before the beginning of the world, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So they left Holland in a tiff and came to America because the only people that they hadn't quarreled with were their own members. Then they came here and broke up into a bunch of little sects. So,
'twas ever thus. Yeah.
Right. So, I think most people have, and in the version of it you'll hear when people try to rehabilitate Thanksgiving in some way, is they'll say, they'll champion the Pilgrim Fathers as, you know, heroes of religious liberty. And as you're bearing witness to, it's a ridiculous idea. The
yeah, that's pretty funny.
There's really, you know, no. If you had been amongst these people, a modern American who had the misfortune of falling among the Pilgrim Fathers,
yeah,
would pretty quickly find that they didn't have liberty.
Right.
And whatever religion they had, most people would have strongly disliked, including today's Calvinists. You know, they were,
right,
these people were nutty.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you can find hardcore Calvinists in America these days, but they don't insist that women and men have separate church services. And, you know, I mean, there's a whole long list of very weird things,
yeah,
that
it was,
were actually involved in.
It was, well, you know, it was as weird as, well, okay, they, well, actually, even that's true. Yeah, it was as weird as Mormonism, and motivated by the same impulses to just get away from everybody who is not us. And eventually, it didn't take them long to follow their the logic of their own positions and quickly turn into Unitarians.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
As denied the deity of Jesus.
Yeah, most Calvinism does eventually.
Yeah. Well, I remember Scott Hahn one time remarking that. How did he put it? He said, Calvinism, I forget the exact word that he used, the language that he used, but it was something to the effect of Calvinism is monotheism in chemical purity. Catholicism is Trinitarian monotheism in chemical purity. And so that's
pretty good. Scott Hahn used to be a pretty hardcore Calvinist evangelist.
Right, yeah.
And he was in the harder core wing of it.
And New England's history bears that out. New England was fairly quickly transmuted from Calvinist Puritanism to Unitarianism, and to the rejection of the deity of Jesus, and ultimately, practically, to the, you know, to, if you go to Harvard and Yale, you know, to the rejection of theism altogether.
Well, it's interesting if you follow their history to hit some of the stops along the way. The one of the first things they did was get into a kind of a frenzy of purity about their theocratic government. You often hear people, these modern liberals today, say that anybody who wants to ban abortion believes in theocracy, which is nonsensical. But the idea that these guys have believed in a theocracy, I mean, church government and the government of the state of Massachusetts were one and the same.
Right.
And the that one of the first things they stopped to do was to launch a very violent persecution against the Quakers that emerged in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Now, in many ways, Quakers are the exact opposite, even though people tend to confuse them. I mean, most people who have a box of Quaker oats in their house with a picture of William Penn on it,
mm-hmm,
have some idea that he must have been one of the Pilgrims.
Right.
And in reality, they're the complete opposite of each other.
They would have killed him if they could. Yeah.
They did in fact kill many of them.
Yeah.
There were many Quakers that were literally hanged and I think burned alive in some cases.
There's an interesting story. I forget her name, but there was a woman, a Puritan woman from Massachusetts Bay Colony.
Right. Yeah.
Who developed a and very understandable, by the way, empathy for Quakers who were dedicated pacifists.
Right.
And
this woman's name was Elizabeth. I'm drawing a blank on her last name.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
Yeah, it's an interesting story.
She's an amazing story. Yeah, so she became a Quaker. She became convinced in her conscience that she had to side with Quakers against this barbarism that was being meted out to them. So they exiled her to Rhode Island, and she comes back to Massachusetts Bay determined to be a martyr. And then at the last minute, she gets found not guilty or not hanged. And she's like really mad about this. So they send her away again, and she comes back again. And then finally, whoever's running Massachusetts Bay Colony says, fine, you want me to kill you? I will kill you. And he does. But the experience of the Quakers in the U.S. and especially confronted with – you know, those champions of religious liberty.
Right, right, right.
The pilgrims.
Well, for the benefit of the readers that may not know, Quakerism is, in some ways, Protestantism taken to its logical conclusion. Mm-hmm. In other words, the original Protestants said, we believe the Bible only, sola scriptura. We don't believe in popes or church councils or church fathers or any of these other things. We're going to cut it down to one source of authority.
Right.
The Quakers just dropped the other shoe. They said, well, what's so special about the Bible?
Right.
They said, this is just some old book put together by old white guys. Mm-hmm. They might not have called them old white guys, but that was the gist of it.
Yeah.
And if you find inspiration in the Bible, great. You know, but there's no authority. We don't have leaders. We don't have rules. We've been spun too much by all of this authority.
In some ways,
Quakerism's perfect for now, you know.
Yeah, well, it was the appeal to the direct intuition of the Holy Spirit by the individual.
Right. That it's similar in some ways to charismatic or Pentecostal Christianity,
yeah.
except
yeah.
that those groups still have a high role for the inspiration of the Bible.
Yeah.
Quakerism is makes the Bible itself optional,
but it you know, so
it's not too surprising that they got into trouble with the Puritans.
Sure, they were. Yeah, it was kind of the, you know, the ultimate sort of expression of the individual conscience versus the community. And what was remarkable about it was that they were really dedicated pacifists. They really believed in holding to their word. So when they made treaties with natives, they were the only colonists who didn't break their treaties, because you can't do that, you know. And
right. William Penn was remarkable
they really did.
Main views on all of that.
Yeah, and they really did lay down their lives for this. So you know, you have people like, I wish I could remember her name, but the Massachusetts Bay colonist who was determined to bear witness, you know, to the authority of conscience over, you know, the state that was murdering Quakers. And they were also amazingly ahead of their time in the fact that they deliberately and with tremendous personal cost to themselves, sometimes completely bankrupting themselves, they discerned together in the middle of the 18th century, they discerned that slavery was forbidden by God. And they just all gave up their slaves. And if it ruined them, that's what we have to do.
Hard guys to dislike in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I have a lot of respect, especially for the Quakers of that era. You know, and they did. They were deeply hated by people. Understandably, because, you know, the integrity of a witness like that makes every compromised person very uncomfortable.
Right.
It is hilarious that William Penn is always mistaken for a Puritan.
Right.
And very ironic.
Yeah.
Another episode that's worth looking into for a few minutes is the fact that the Puritans, they believed in purity. So they wanted to drive people out of Massachusetts who weren't Puritan and succeeded to a large degree.
Right.
The only one of the original colonies that actually was settled on a charter of religious liberty, and this is a nice piece of irony, was the colony of Maryland, which was founded by Lord Baltimore and his sons.
Right.
They were Catholic, and so they had seen a lot of persecution in the homeland for the previous 100 years.
Yeah.
But they deliberately founded their colony as religious freedom.
Yeah.
In other words, no religious tests. No only requirement to vote was that you had to be a believer in God. It was religious freedom in almost the modern sense.
Right.
And it was the only one of the, original colonies for which that was true.
Yeah.
And, the others either had established Anglicanism or some right. other established church.
And, and it remained, built on the principle of religious liberty right up until the moment that it became a majority Protestant colony.
That's right. Yes. This is the ironic story.
Catholics were instantly outlawed.
Well, unlike Puritanism,
yeah.
the Marylanders said, oh yeah, you guys can come and live in our colony. All are welcome.
Right.
You know? So, and then, of course, when the Puritans became a majority in Maryland, they instantly outlawed Catholicism.
Yes.
It is a very interesting story, but not much like what you're taught in schools, that the papists were the heroes of religious freedom.
Well, that's part of – one of the things that's interesting to me is, you know, that essentially what happened in the United States was that as time went on – Americans, in a certain sense, hypocritically, and in a certain sense, I think, to our credit, embraced the print the legend version of Puritan history. And the reason, you know, the hypocrisy is obvious. It's not really the way things happened. But on the other hand, what you get, and one of the things, I think it's the great ironies of our Puritan heritage, is... You know, it's easy when you're the young hothead to look at your Anglican dad and say, you're not pure enough. We're going to America. And then you go there and you're going to found your city on a hill and it's all going to be perfect, you know. But then you get old and fat and you've got kids and your kids are like looking for something to look up to. And so what do you wind up with? Well, you wind up with... Religious liberty is good. And the pilgrims, you know, were heroes. And above all, you wind up, as you have to do if you're going to build a civilization, you wind up becoming venerable, which is the last thing that the Puritans
right.
saw themselves as ever being, was venerable. And the great irony, of course, is that this movement – that came here absolutely bound and determined to get rid of the liturgical, to get rid of anything that even smelled Romish, winds up having a national feast whose name in Greek is Eucharist.
Isn't it great? Isn't it great?
Yeah.
Well, that's actually another aspect of this story that is worth bringing out, is the fact that there was a rather conscious effort in those early decades by Puritans and former Puritans to put up Thanksgiving as an alternative to Christmas.
Ah, okay.
Remember, the Puritans made war on Christmas before they left England.
Yeah.
They not all of the Puritans left, but the Puritans, they called Yuletide Fooltide.
Yeah.
And they made war on the whole idea of Christmas, and during Oliver Cromwell's reign, it was outlawed.
Right.
And there were laws against keeping Christmas.
Right.
Which of course, the Anglicans had allowed.
Right.
And continued.
Right.
Much of the old church calendar.
Yeah.
But in the very thoroughgoing Puritans who came in with Cromwell outlawed it. So
well, it's Mencken's definition of Puritanism was the haunting fear that someone somewhere was having a good time.
Well, it does have the word mass in it.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
You hear a lot about keep Christ in Christmas these days, but I'd like to put the mass back in Christmas. And it sometimes makes people angry.
Right.
People put up keep Christ in Christmas signs. But the mass was something that the Puritans hated. And the whole idea of feast days, special days on the calendar, all of that was paganism to them, too.
Right.
So, but they did think that it might be a good thing to commemorate their own safe arrival. And right. So Thanksgiving was put forward as a kind of a way that the weaker brethren could continue to have an early winter feast and
right.
not get mixed up in the popery of Christmas.
The popery. So, well, yeah, it's sort of like I remember as a young evangelical, you know, of course, Halloween bad. So what can we do? Well, you know, but our kids are like, you know, all the other kids get to have fun stuff going on Halloween. Well, let's have a harvest feast. You know, okay, we'll have a harvest feast,
Nanny.
Yeah, so, okay, we'll have a harvest feast, but not, we won't call it Halloween. But, you know, I mean, do we really just want to be celebrating, you know, secular things like food and drink? We should find a way to spiritualize it somehow. I know, we could turn it into, you know, like a celebration of the harvest of, like, souls, you know, for the kingdom of heaven. And, you know, by little fits and starts, of course, what we wound up doing was reinventing Halloween.
it's so fascinating to watch people reinventing the wheel without realizing.
Yeah, yeah. So you know, and that's what I think is hilarious about. I can't help but see it as sort of another little act of providence. Well, one of the things that I've noticed over time is that honest people, as they sort of try to figure out the world, wind up rediscovering Catholic truths, because Catholic truths aren't prescriptive, they're descriptive. They actually tell us the way the world works. And so if you actually really try to understand the world, you're gonna wind up rediscovering Catholic truths. So my wife knows a woman who, she's an evangelical, and she had a conversation with her some years ago, and she remarked that at her church they were starting to study the lives of people who lived after the time of the Bible, and seeing, you know, how it was that they obeyed God and what they learned from God. And as long as my wife didn't use the phrase "cult of the saints," the conversation went on just swimmingly.
Right.
Because that's what they were discovering, you know. Or you know, I run into evangelicals who've got the bumper stickers that say "Please be patient, God isn't finished with me yet." And as long as I don't say, you know, that's actually the Catholic theology of sanctification, right? Then it's fine. Everything's fine, you know. And the same thing happens here. Is you've got a national culture that was founded by people who were in the most violent reaction you could possibly have. Against not merely the Catholic Church, which they no longer even remembered because it had already been outlawed for a good long while, but in violent reaction against anything in other Protestant churches that even smelled Catholic.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And what do they wind up doing? They wind up establishing a national feast that means Eucharist.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating.
So I love that.
Yeah, there are many, many, many examples of this in evangelicalism. I remember wondering at the time when I was evangelical that people were constantly I wasn't even in the process of being converted, or not consciously anyway. Mm-hmm. And I was always all the time finding people who would say things, who would admit that they had this secret temptation to pray for the dead.
Sure.
That they had to constantly suppress.
Yeah, you got to muscle that down.
Yeah.
You know, it's so natural.
And then I had other friends who sort of admitted to me like they were admitting a secret vice, that they believed that Christ was present in the Lord's Supper, and it wasn't just a symbol.
Right, yeah.
That happened to me on many occasions, several occasions. So,
yeah.
It's, yeah.
So it's like
very this, interesting.
I sometimes I think of the Holy Spirit sort of exerting a kind of, I don't know what you call it, it's like a positive hydrostatic pressure on things, you know, that the moment you stop doggedly resisting some obvious thing that the church teaches is the moment that it immediately comes back and you go, well, this makes perfect sense. You know, it's like, right. You know, I remember reading there's a passage out of Francis Crick where he remarks that he has to tell his students, he constantly tells his students that they must remind themselves that the things that they are studying, Crick is the discoverer of the DNA molecule and a famous atheist. And he tells his students, you must remind yourself at all times that the things that you are studying were not designed. They were evolved. They were not designed. There's no design here. You must crush that impulse. Right. To right. Look at, you know, the things that you're looking at, and he must not be designed.
He had taught this course before, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah. And because, of course, the moment you stop muscling down the impulse to look at the universe and not see design, it's everywhere all the time. it hits you in the face all the time. And that's something that I've seen again and again is this, you get these sort of moments of fever in a culture where for some reason people have this maniacal need to deny something obviously true. And so they do that for a while until that generation kind of just sort of dies out. And then their kids come back and say, why did we insist on this crazy thing? You know?
Yeah.
Why did we, you know, run after Stalin and say, you know, Stalin is doing great work. Yeah. We all have to
say that. Or more to the point there, I mean, why don't we have freedom? Why can't we express contrary opinions and have free newspapers and free religion and all the rest of it? Well, yeah. It's the temporary dictatorship of the proletariat.
Yeah, right.
You're going to get those things, all those things back eventually.
Yeah.
Once the crisis is over.
Yeah.
You know, but right now, you know,
we have to
temporarily, we have to have, you know, there's a war on, you know.
Exactly.
So, but after 50, 60, 70 years, the temporary people started saying, if this is temporary, then then I don't see much difference between temporary and permanent.
Yeah,
especially since no sign of the new millennium was in evidence.
Yeah,
so you know, the whole thing came crashing down pretty much overnight.
Yeah. So and you know, in American history, you know, similar things have obtained. You know, once the Puritans passed from the scene. Who completely denied altogether the possibility of human freedom because everything is predestined. You know, who do they give birth to? Well, they give birth to American revolutionaries whose entire focus and obsession is liberty.
Pretty fascinating.
And,
yeah, there's a whole other discussion in there is the one of the most fascinating subjects in American history is the religion of the founding fathers.
Right.
It's an exceptionally fascinating subject.
Right.
The one guy that often gets a lot of heat, Thomas Jefferson, because he dared to edit the New Testament and the Jefferson Bible and all the rest of it, is actually, ironically, the most self-consciously religious of all of the early founders, a much more religious person than the saintly feeling and pious George Washington. Mm-hmm. I mean, and one of the reasons why he doubled down so hard on his belief in God and insisted on it so thoroughly and was such a thoroughgoing believer in God, theist,
mm-hmm.
is because he worried that the rejection of the rest of revealed Christianity, the deity of Christ and all the rest of it, would endanger the world with atheism, which he was terrified of.
Mm-hmm.
And and you see the same thing in the French Revolution, too.
Yeah.
At the moment that they're beheading and doing all their horrible things to priests and nuns, they are inventing a new Catholic Church with a cult of the supreme being, with a church calendar and all the rest of it.
Right.
Talking about reinventing the wheel.
Yeah.
And it's because they were terrified of that they'd open Pandora's box. And
yeah.
So they said, we absolutely got to stick to belief in God.
Well, what's
can't
interesting,
drop that part.
What's interesting in the American founding, of course, is you've got, it was remarked a few years back by Peter Berger that if Sweden is the most secular nation in the world and India is the most religious, then America can best be described as a nation of Hindus ruled by Swedes, which I thought was perceptive. You know, and there's something of that, I think, going on in the American Revolution as well, as you've got an elite that is... for the most part, is skeptic. It's theistic, but it's skeptical of Christian claims. But at the same time, it feels in its bones the truth of Christian teaching on original sin.
Right. Well, I'm much more sympathetic towards these guys than most people because
mm-hmm.
The more you know about the previous 150 years of the more you know about the previous 150 years of English history,
mm-hmm.
which was their immediate background.
Right.
You know, that was to them what MLK and FDR and all that is to us.
Right.
And that story, the story of Christianity, the English Reformation, is one of the least edifying stories in the world.
Yeah.
It's a really horrific thing to look into.
Oh, yeah.
It would lead the very elect to swear off of religion forever if that were possible.
Yeah, it's true. The English Reformation is just an ugly thing.
Yeah, I mean, there's just it's more horrifying the longer you look at it.
Yeah,
and this is the spectacle that these men had in front of their eyes.
Right,
and it's heroic virtue on their part that they didn't all become atheists,
mm-hmm.
in my opinion.
Yeah.
And,
Well, go ahead. Well, I was going to say what's interesting though, is that for the average American, of that same period, popular piety obtains as it was practiced in England, so celebrations of Christmas and, you know, the normal, and you can see this, for example, in the literature that comes out of the Civil War. Everybody on both sides is a believing Protestant Christian. You know, there are some Catholics in there. There's a handful of Jews there. But for the most part, the piety that you see expressed in the Civil War is kind of generic American Protestant piety. You know, people sang the Battle of the Hymn of the Republic without any sense of irony. This was true blue popular piety. We are doing God's work here. And nobody questioned that, you know, that has been true for most of American history. America is one of the few countries in the world. If a British politician were to conclude a speech by saying "God bless you" and "God bless the United Kingdom," he would be regarded as a freak. What are you doing, dragging God into all this?
Right.
If an American doesn't end a speech that way, Something is seriously wrong with this guy. The pieties must be observed. And so it's very much like a Roman senator of the Republic. The popular pieties must be observed because the people really take seriously these pieties. And I find that really interesting. And Thanksgiving is part of that. Thanksgiving is
most definitely
a civic holiday. But it is a civic holiday that is focused on, and you can see this in, for example, in Lincoln's proclamations of Thanksgiving. Why are we doing this? We're doing this because God has been merciful to us, and we are going to, as a nation, thank God. You know, and he promulgates these in the middle of the bloodiest war of American history. But we are going to, as a nation, thank God for what's been given to us. And he says this without irony. This is not an act of cynicism for him.
And yet there are ironies there. Lincoln himself was nobody's idea of an Orthodox Christian.
Oh, no, not at all.
And a very tortured doubter.
Right.
He was he doesn't seem to have been an atheist, definitely not an atheist, but he probably was some kind of an agnostic, but he wasn't a happy agnostic.
Well, he comes out,
he didn't enjoy being an agnostic.
No, yeah, and I think he very much really, you know, according to the kind of Protestant Bible Belt, whatever it was that he was exposed to as, you know, a kid growing up in, you know, Kentucky. I think he does his best on his own because he did everything on his own.
Right.
Including educate himself, you know.
Uh-huh.
He's cobbling together the best as he can some kind of attempt to understand what is going on. You know, I think that the second inaugural is right from his guts and marrow. I think
he absolutely
believes when he says that, you know, if it be necessary that the 400 years of toil, you know, be atoned for, you know, and that every stroke of the lash be atoned by another from the sword, then as it was said 3,000 years ago, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. I think he means that with every atom. And so, yeah, he is somebody who is very much soaked, as everybody in his time is. He's soaked in biblical thoughts and images.
I think he was a little more than a lot of them. You know, a lot of them, it was a go along to get along.
Right,
know?
Right.
As most Christianity is in every group.
Yeah, yeah.
Most people are
doing their duty. That's the danger of a Christian culture always, is that on the one hand, there's a certain advantage to Christian ideas and assumptions being second nature. It does a lot
Lincoln
of heavy lifting for us.
Lincoln was the sort of guy who couldn't hear anything without thinking it through.
Yeah, exactly right.
He couldn't hear any idea expressed without going somewhere and pondering it for hours.
Right.
So,
yeah. And I think that because of that, and because, you know, I think Lincoln is acutely sensitive to the fact that all the arguments for slavery and secession are also always based on attempts to reconcile all of that with Christianity.
Right. He's been thrown in his teeth for 20 years.
Right, right. I think, you know, that's one of the major reasons that he finds Christianity so difficult to buy. Is because he can see that how it's used for evil. But at the same time, he's smart enough to see. Yeah, I don't think there was any question ever that Abraham Lincoln was an atheist or could buy that. I don't think it was in him to buy that. But yeah, he's
about me. It may have been haunted by the specter of it, but no, I don't think he ever disbelieved in God.
Yeah, and so when he promulgates Thanksgiving, and Thanksgiving's already been a kind of sporadically, it's been an honored tradition in the United States from long before Lincoln's time, but Lincoln thinks that it is fitting to make it a civic holiday for the entire nation. And Americans just take to that like ducks to water. Yeah, of course, you know, 19th century Americans wouldn't think twice about that.
No.
And so it's interesting that, yeah, that we have this country that does that. There is, I mean, there's Thanksgiving in Canada because of course they share as well, in the Puritan heritage that we do.
Well, yeah, the divorce didn't happen for some years after that. So
yeah,
British America and newly independent ex-British America.
Yeah, yeah. So it's, for me, it's always been fascinating that we have this civic holiday that kind of intuitively grasped against all the, you know, if there was ever a religious culture that could possibly have done more and more consciously to extirpate everything to do with the Catholic tradition, I can't think of one better suited to it than the Puritans. And yet out of that culture and no other, ironically, God chooses to bring the civic celebration of Thanksgiving, which is basically just Puritans going, you know, there should be something like a mass if we didn't believe in mass.
Right. So even though we've just spent the last hour debunking just about everything about Thanksgiving, we still finish up by saying God bless it. And
God bless it. I love Thanksgiving. I'm so grateful for it. Yeah.
Forever.
Yeah, and, I love the chance to get together. And that's, you know, that's one of the curious things, by the way, about both the Jewish and the Christian tradition of Thanksgiving is so much of giving thanks simply consists of saying, hey, we should give thanks, which is an odd thing when you think about it,
right,
you know?
Right.
I've actually done this as a kind of a discipline sometimes, and I found it very, very, nourishing. It's simply, I took a walk one time and I just spent the whole walk I started as far back as I could go thinking about my own life and trying to give thanks for everything that I could remember. And what astounded me was how much I could remember that I was grateful for and how all the things that at the time I had been worried about were like, yeah, I don't really even remember why I was so worried about that dumb thing. Right. You know?
Well, because there's a perfect Mark Twain quote for that. Mark Twain said, I've been through some really terrible things in my life. Some of which actually happened.
Yes. So true. So true.
Yep.
And so, you know, I go back to, you know, I can remember sitting in a high chair and my mom feeding me custard with a spoon.
How about that?
And I remember at the time thinking to myself that I liked the word custard. I thought custard was a good sounding word. It was a satisfying word to say. And you know, that's
birth of a literary man.
Well, but that's 60 years ago. Yeah. And I can still remember that. And I am still grateful for that moment of my mom feeding me custard. That will be with me the day I die. And you start doing that. You start going back over your life and thinking about all the things that you were handed. I was just this last weekend. I went to my brother's house. They decided to hold a slideshow of their respective tours of duty in Vietnam. And as they did so, they kept telling stories about stuff that happened there. Rod Bennett, my brothers, on multiple occasions, came literally within inches of being shot in the head. Or my one brother was nearly in a plane crash that would have killed him, you know.
Wow.
Yeah. And was nearly hit by a crashing plane another time.
Wow.
And, you know, these things that happened, had they happened, you know, would have wrecked my life. I mean, these were, and I look at this and I was oblivious to them at the time. I'd lived most of my life not really being clearly aware that this happened until they were telling these stories. And I sat there and I thought, God has been so good to me. I'm so grateful that my brothers are not dead. You know, we're not killed. They're not on that wall.
Absolutely. This is where the instinct to make time travel stories comes from. that little thing that if it had gone slightly differently,
yeah,
how it would have impacted so many people.
Yeah. Yeah. My brother, during the Tet Offensive, my brother was, he was trapped along with the rest of his Air Force unit in this hotel in a town called Canto, way down in the Mekong Delta. And they were just sort of this tiny island in a sea of Viet Cong that overran the town during the Tet Offensive. And he was standing up there talking to a friend on top of the building, on top of the hotel. And he said he heard something, you know, whistle past his ear. And he looked at this piece of plywood that was near his head, and it had a hole in it. And he looked at it and said, was that there before? And then he heard something else whistle past his ear, and then there were two holes there. And he said, I think somebody's shooting at us. And, you know, it literally was close enough that he heard it go past his ear. And, wow. You know, it's just like, I had no idea. And that's just one out of a billion things that I could name that I'm grateful for. You know, I'm grateful for my family and my kids. And
even as we were speaking just now, my wife handed me a note telling me that my son, got a job that he's been trying very hard to get.
Thanks be to God.
I just learned about it a few seconds ago, so I'm going to join in with Thanksgiving here.
Yeah.
You won't believe how great this is. This is my son suffers from OCD, and he has had trouble keeping a job
mm-hmm.
because it caused problems with his work.
Mm-hmm.
And he's finally gotten a job that or at least had a trial or probationary period with the job that looked very promising. But, you know, we all had a kind of a fearful feeling about it because he's been disappointed in the past.
Yeah.
And we just got the word that he's officially hired on. So,
wonderful. Yeah.
So another thanks be to God moment. So
wonderful. I'm so grateful to hear it. You know, we could go on, but I'm sure you have a life to live, and we've been at this for an hour.
Jack will be home in a few minutes, and I do want to celebrate with him.
Okay,
so.
All right. Well, then this is as good a time as any to thank you for being on the podcast today, and to urge those out there who are going to be celebrating Thanksgiving, just stop and you know. Take a while and think about everything that you've got to be grateful for. You live in a free country. You are not living in a place where you have to fear that somebody's going to shoot you for going to mass on Thanksgiving Day.
Right.
And you have people in your life who love you. You've got the technology to be listening to a podcast for crying out loud. Isn't that amazing? And to be, for me to make a podcast. I mean, isn't that astonishing? That some slob like you and me can get on the air, talk to each other. You're in Tennessee, I'm in Washington State, and the people out there are, you know, could be in Antarctica for all we know, and we can all listen to this. It's wonderful. What a wonderful time to be alive. So
indeed.
Thanks be to God for all of that, and thanks be to God, especially, we speak as Catholics here, for the gift of Jesus Christ and for the gift especially of Christ present in the Eucharist to us.
Amen.
Making us participants in the divine nature. Wow. What a world.
Indeed.
So I want to thank you, Rod Bennett, for being on the show today. I want to thank you guys out there for listening to Connecting the Dots. And until we speak again, have a wonderful, glorious, beautiful Thanksgiving. Bye-bye.
So long.